Welcome to the HPS Cast. I'm your host, Colbert Cannon. We've reached the end of our 10th season, so today we're listening back to our best moments. This season, I had the great pleasure of speaking with individuals I admire across healthcare, law, and media, as well as my own colleagues at HPS and peers in finance. I'm grateful to all of our guests for taking the time to share their knowledge and stories with us, and thanks to you, dear listener, for tuning in. We're taking a quick break, but season 11 is coming soon. So now, without any further ado, listen for a recap of the moments that made this season. We launched with none other than Kristin Kalergis-Rowland, Global Head of Alternatives at JP Morgan Wealth Management.
What's your perspective on private credit as an asset class at this point in the market cycle?
Credit is super interesting to me. I can understand all the reasons why small and medium-sized businesses use private lenders. We've skewed towards larger managers, like I said. I think that will serve us well on a go-forward basis. In special sits and distress, we've skewed actually towards smaller managers who are going after more niche sector-specific opportunities that we think are specialists in that space. But I just think the biggest question I ask my clients when they say, is private credit interesting? I say, like, what's your funding source? Because if your funding source is public fixed income, there are many managers out there who can give you that illiquidity premium that you deserve if you're going to take the illiquidity of private markets.
David Lehman, a managing director in HPS's real estate finance practice, shared his take on the sector.
You mentioned this in terms of the timing and the rates move. You know, real estate is a cyclical business, which people forget because we spent the better part of two decades with the most accommodative central bank policies in history. When you look at that landscape now, what gets you most excited about real estate finance?
The 15 years of the zero interest rate environment that you referenced before, that caused a lot of investing, a lot of growth in portfolios. For example, banks doubled their portfolios in real estate lending from 2012 to last year. And you just saw decision-making as a result of that environment that I think is being unwound right now. And I think that that is the opportunity when you had real interest rates go from close to negative 100 basis points at the end of 21 to close to positive 200 basis points now. That type of move coupled with the growth in portfolios and where assets have been aggregated, I think you're going to see new lending, new owners of those assets for the next cycle, whether that be 15 or 20 years.
We touched on artificial intelligence with an expert in the field, Salim Ismail, the co-founder and executive director of OpenXO, a global community connecting professionals with organizations to navigate disruptive technologies.
If you are even a smart and discerning type of reader, you could read a lot of articles about AI and come up with two binary outcomes. Either A, it's the Terminator movies, robots are taking over, humanity's doomed, or AI ushers in a utopian future, saves humanity and the world, and everything's fine. Why do you think the truth's somewhere in the middle?
I don't think the truth is in the middle. I think the truth is very much on the AI saves humanity side.
Okay.
The reason that we go down the other side is that when you see technology portrayed by Hollywood, you always see a negative dystopian outcome. The robot overlords turn to take over the world. But the reality of how we're exploring the world with technology is very, very different. If you think about PageRank, Google's AI that's crawling web pages around the world, it's designing and developing a completely different type of intelligence that's complementary to human intelligence, not replicative. Human beings are evolved for 4 billion years to do two things, to survive and procreate. And AI is not limited with those issues. So why would we think that's where we'll end up?
Dr. Brendan Carr, CEO of the Mount Sinai Health System, offered sage advice for stepping into new and challenging roles, something he knows a thing or two about after joining Mount Sinai to run their emergency department just 1 month before the global pandemic hit New York.
I'm always interested in how people come up the curve on new experiences. How else do you figure out how to do what you didn't have to do in the old gig?
I mean, the good news is that there's an enormously deep bench of expertise here. And I remember what I did. For those who don't know what emergency medicine is, it means that we stand at the front door and whatever comes, comes, and we figure it out. And figuring that out when you are alone in a rural hospital in the middle of nowhere is very different than figuring that out when you're at a giant academic medical center, where at 3 o'clock in the morning, if I would like the power of Mount Sinai to emerge, I just have to light it up and it will. It means that you get very, very comfortable knowing when to know what you know and knowing when you need some guidance and some help, knowing when to call the consult and when not to call the consult. And so I am very happy to reach out to the brilliant finance folks that we have here or the brilliant business development folks that we have here. I very, very much believe that, you know, the best leaders are mostly invisible and that when people look back, they just pat themselves on the back for having gotten there.
We caught up with Jay Goffman, a bankruptcy lawyer with True Business Acumen and the co-founder and co-CEO of Smith Goffman Partners. For listeners less in tune to bankruptcy law, what is a prepack bankruptcy? And is it factually correct that you invented the prepack, Jay?
Yes, I did come up with the idea. For all I know, somebody else may have been thinking about it, but to my knowledge, I invented the idea one night. I can tell you how and when. But essentially, a prepack is, it's a restructuring where you do all the negotiations on an out-of-court basis, which avoids all the costs and the degradation to the business. And then when you have your votes in hand, then you go into Chapter 11 for a short period of time, you know, anywhere from 30 days down to a day, in order to confirm the case, make it binding on holdouts and anyone else you couldn't find, and to take advantages of the other tools of Chapter 11. It's a way to shorten restructurings from when I started, they were going 5, 6, 7, 8 years down to a matter of days by looking at it as a business transaction. And I always thought that made sense.
Pranima Puri, who leads HPS's public credit strategies, shared her views on the future of credit documentation in a panel discussion for the pod. Private credit historically benefited from tighter docs, but with so much capital raised, some private lenders were willing to forego strong creditor protections. With the markets on the liquid side open at least for high-quality issuers and so much dry powder in private credit, will the pendulum swing back towards looser documentation?
I think probably yes. So a couple things. The first is that this year, the new issues have been predominantly, I think the number is 67% refinancings. So it hasn't been sort of core new issue issues. The second is a lot of it has been much higher quality issuers. So the minute you get into the higher quality issuers, you're going to actually see looser documents. In the same way, if you take the extreme investment grade documents, have the loosest documents in the bond markets.
We took a sweeping tour of Asia through the lens of foreign policy with Jonathan Stromseth, professor of the practice at Duke University's Sanford School of Public Policy. You spent time across a range of countries in your time there, Thailand, Vietnam, China. How important to your work was that exposure you got throughout the region?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I was very happy after 5 or 6 years in Vietnam to get the chance to basically be the country representative of the Asia Foundation in China. And I was the first not to be based in Hong Kong, but to actually be based up in Beijing, and then spent another 8 or 9 years there. But I did Southeast Asian studies in grad school. And it was just so great to see kind of the macro sense of how China relates to the rest of the region.
We were joined by Gareth Mee, Chief Financial Officer at Legal & General Capital, the investing arm of one of the UK's largest insurance and asset management businesses. Gareth shared how private credit fits into L&G's portfolio. So insurance companies obviously have long-dated liabilities, need long-duration assets to satisfy them. L&G has been investing in private credit for some time. Why? Why does private credit make sense for L&G?
There is a limited universe of corporate bonds, particularly here in the UK market. Once you start getting out to 10, 15 years, or even actually beyond 7 years, and we've got them all, and all of our competitors have got them all. So you run out of diversification on those long-dated corporate bonds. And we have an insatiable appetite for assets that back our long-dated liabilities. So first of all, we need a bigger pool to be able to fish in. Secondly, the returns on these corporate bonds vary, and the returns on the liabilities that we're out there pricing also vary, in some cases not as significantly. But one of the features throughout my career that has made a difference in the insurance products that we work in here at Legal & General is the ability to find the best assets. And so it has been really, really important. And at various points in the cycle, then we've had to use different mechanisms. But over the last 10 years, an ability to originate the best private credit in the market in the most capital efficient way has become something that has been a differentiator for Legal & General and some of our peers.
Chris Stanton, a managing director in HPS's London office focused on direct lending and special situations investing, shared his thoughts on the European credit market. We have colleagues on the ground in the continent in Europe, but our biggest office in Europe is obviously in London. How do you think philosophically about lending into various countries across Europe?
one of the priorities when we're looking at deals is how do you plan for a scenario where something doesn't go well? What does that downside case look like? And unlike many others, our deals generally have covenants. So there will be an early trigger if something goes awry. And what does that actually mean? So where is your asset security? Where is your share pledge? You know, there are certain jurisdictions in Europe, particularly in the south of the continent, where it is going to be very hard to do, I guess, a non-consensual recut of the cap stack. In the northern part of the continent, actually, it's more straightforward to do a non-consensual. I think that's one of the fundamentals of doing any credit investment is being able to catch it on the downside and also control your destiny. So at HVS, we generally think it's important to ideally speak for all the tranche or a majority of the tranche, write the document yourself from first principles, and have the covenant and security package to be able to act if the deal goes awry.
We wrap this season with a showstopper, a conversation with Emmy Award-winning comedy and television writer Robert Carlock. Rob is perhaps best known for his work as the showrunner of Tina Fey's 30 Rock. He shares his best advice for fostering long-lasting relationships in business and life. I want to talk about your partnership with Tina because you've continued working together. Mm-hmm. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which is also great, the movie Whiskey Tango Foxtrot. Partnerships and how people maintain those always interests me. Like, how have you sustained your execution at a high level over time? Like, how do you make that work for as long as you guys have?
I don't know how conscious we are of it in terms of best practices. You know, we have a good social relationship, which helps seeing each other with spouses. And Tina's husband, Jeff Richmond, is an incredibly talented composer and does all our music, and our kids are friends. So I think that actually really helps to see, to be reminded of each other's humanity.
Yeah.
When you step out of the, what can be the stress of meeting these deadlines and ratings numbers and notes and whatever else, and dealing with actors. In terms of the work, again, it's a question of communication, I think, and expectations.
Thanks again to all of our guests for joining me this season. We'll be back soon with all new episodes. Until then, I encourage you to check out any episodes you might have missed, or you can visit our show notes to find links to all of our best ideas. This podcast was brought to you by At Will Media with HPS Investment Partners. Please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. See you in the next season. The opinions expressed on this podcast are that of the host, Colbert Cannon, and the guest of each episode, and do not necessarily reflect the views of HPS Investment Partners.